soon, till my horse tired through darts and balloons, till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars, till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland.
The rule book and calendar of Kittery Embers. Chapter 14, The Cloud of Stone. On the porch, in her chair, where she mostly sat these days, Kittery watched the clouds skid over the grey chiselled sea. She always heard the ocean, and never didn't, even inside. The grumbling air filled her head like the talking of the earth. The marriage of wind and water made the roar, not just the sea, though it was easy to forget. It was the sound of the earth, a figmentary voice that could never find a single word to say. When she was a girl, the sun-setting clouds were the brightest beauty in the world, pink and yellow damsels burning over the graveyard of wild water. But now it was the graveyard itself, the long granite tomb of the sea, that held her. At night, if it was warm enough, and she could convince them to let her sit outside, it was not the moon or stars that she studied. It was the darkness itself, the robbed space between the stars. Whatever wasn't, whatever had been, whatever was gone away, the absent presence that both preceded and followed, that held it all together. "It's almost lunch," Mrs. Gramshaw called through an open window. A coarse scent of butter and bread followed her announcement like an echo. Kittery turned her head in acknowledgement. She could not see him, but her son, Samuel, sat beside her on the porch. She could hear the flip of pages and the wriggling of his pen. Whatever he was doing likely involved her. He was working beside her as a clever way of pressing the matter into her memory so she wouldn't forget. But she would, and she had, and there wasn't anything that could change that. If it was a speech, she wouldn't be able to memorize it, let alone read it. But then again, his confusion was, in part, her own fault. Sam couldn't help but overestimate her current abilities. Kittery would never quite permit any of them to know just how lost it all was, how weak her memory, how dim her eyes. There was a sudden bump against her chair, probably lunch. "Are you there?" she called out, her hand shifting at once to the brake levers. "Not yet, Mum," Sam said. "She sneaks up on me," Kittery said. "She doesn't sneak," Sam replied. Kittery set the metal latches down. She was still in charge of the brakes. That was a firm understanding. It gave her a sense of volition. She didn't like suddenly being swept off from here or there, the whole world shooting vertiginously away. Though her eyes had weakened to their current, perhaps final, ocular temper, she could still see the very far away. The horizon, the waves, the occasional boat, the stars in their too precious glinting, anything that might require a telescope. But the periphery had been sheared completely away. Needle vision is what she called it, but only to herself. While Sam was invisible where he sat, and the horizon waves were clean and bright, the rest of the ruminating world was piled in haze. The yellow ruffled rails of the porch, the chopped up and blended green of the grass, and ebony of the cinder driveway. It wasn't just her eyes that had fallen into an exclusive arrangement with distance. Her memory, too, spied through the blur of years to the clarity of long ago. Her first arrival at the house, so many years ago, was as clear as yesterday, though yesterday itself was lost. To recall yesterday, she referred herself to today. She had likely done exactly this, sat on the porch, watched the sea, waited for the next meal. Perhaps Sam was there, writing something for her to read or say. "I am here," the voice whispered in her ear. It was likely Mrs. Gramshaw, though every voice sounded the same now. She turned and felt the hand touch her shoulder. "It's Mrs. Gramshaw, Kittery. Are you ready to go in, or do you want lunch out here?" All questions were riddles, neither here nor there. Every answer was equidistant from her want, and so she never knew exactly what. Did she want to go in or stay out? She wasn't even sure she wanted lunch. "Has Archie sat down?" Kittery asked. "He has, and Sam has gone in as well," Mrs. Gramshaw said. Kittery released the brakes. That would be her answer. The world swam to her side and darkened until she felt a huff of warm house air. "How is he?" Kittery asked. "Archie? He's very well," the housekeeper said, pushing her down the hall. "Did he walk?" Kittery asked. It was a main and regular inquiry. She would ask her husband as well when they dined. "He did," Mrs. Gramshaw answered, "and nearly wore me out with it, I'm afraid. All the way to the lighthouse, and then without a breath, turned right around and came home." "That's very far," Kittery said, and she struggled to remember something from earlier in the morning. Often she would see a boat dangling over the waves, and she would report her sighting at mealtimes, if she recalled it, as a token of her competence, both vision and memory conspiring crisply together. But in fact, hadn't she seen a man appear quite suddenly beyond the shale at the rising stones before the lighthouse, and then a woman following after? Might that not have been Archie and Mrs. Gramshaw? How strange not to recognize her husband across a mile of beach, the last remaining way she could see him. She hadn't seen anything close, clearly, in a dozen years. When she felt the chair stop rolling, and the stillness of the room hummed against the round breath of the ocean, she struck the brakes down and opened her mouth. A warm salt spread over her tongue and a rough towel rubbed below her chin. She gazed across the table to where Sam would be and let her face rest upon his for a moment. She liked her son to think that she could still see him, and then she turned to the washed-away brown of her husband, struggling to remember what Mrs. Gramshaw had reported. "Did you walk this morning, Archie?" she said. "Archie has just gone off to the kitchen for more soup," Mrs. Gramshaw said, "but he'll return in a moment, and when he does, we can ask again." "He went to the lighthouse, Mum. Keepsie already said." "I was asking your father," Kittery replied. "No, I know. That's fine," Sam said with a laugh. "Did you remember we're going to the ministry for the supper tonight?" "Yes," Kittery said, without the vaguest impression of ever having been told such a thing. "Is it just supper, or is something expected of me? Is it just supper, or is something expected of me?" There was a pacing of silence as the spoon rose once more to her lips and her mouth filled with savoury. The soup was very good. She wasn't sure why there was any doubt about coming inside to eat. "It's your grand send-off, Mum," Sam said after she'd swallowed. "Where am I being sent?" she asked, and realized, with a dizzy contact of irony, that this worked quite well as a joke. The joyful grief of senescence was the ample supply of such humour, which, if one had any finesse, and Kittery did, could always be made to seem self-playing. "They wanted to hear from you a last time," Mrs. Gramshaw said. Mostly they wanted to say thank you. If you're up to it, Sam's written out some words that I may whisper off to you. Won't everyone hear you whisper? Kittery asked, and Sam laughed. They know where you're at, Mum, he said. And where might that be? She said in full seriousness, wondering directly of the mystery of her whereabouts. She let her face go wide and crumble, and was pleased that this too was taken for wit, rather than what it was. What will I say, then? She asked. They were hoping for a last rule, something that brings it all to a close, Sam began. A last rule? Kittery echoed. Why would anyone want a rule? I've patched together some things from your old diary, so it'll be your thoughts, slightly rehashed, I suppose, but that's not so important. They'll want something familiar. That's what I thought, anyway. A hand came across hers, as cold and stony as her own flesh. Is that you, dear? She said, and turned toward her husband. Again she smiled excessively toward the brown fog, hoping he was there. Archie hadn't spoken in years. His voice had begun to depart in the way her vision had, flown off like an exotic bird from the perch in his throat. Even the sounds of his movement, his breathing, were hushed and nearly silent. He's there, Mrs. Gramshaw whispered. He is smiling too. I saw a man down on the beach, Kittery began. And a woman, too, near the lighthouse. I wonder what they were doing down there, and who they might have been.
Though I know it's not the same, it starts up every game. So it swings hard and low. Think I'll take my things and go. So untied and burden free. Down sidewalks light and sweet. All I know is that it seems completely like a dream. Oh, holy, 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 holy daydream. Though I know it's not the same. Holy, 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 holy daydream. So it swings hard and low.
Nightmare of black and yellow shot through the fog. Beside a crushed haystack at the treeless outskirts of Tamerlane, the old woman and the girl in the yellow dress came to a sudden halt. The monarch peered into the darkness of the collapsed hay. You can't expect him to know we're coming, Mrs. Brushes said. Can't I? The monarch said, with a tone of irritation. Nothing but a fraud, and everyone knows it, Mrs. Brushes said, with equal annoyance. The monarch turned from the haystack with a small smile on her face. Mrs. Brushes thinks you're a fraud, Arch Leslie. Tell her otherwise, the monarch commanded. Mrs. Brushes took a sharp breath as Arch Leslie Mumford crawled into view. Before standing he loosened the topmost belt around his chest, and a singular wheeze emerged from his lips. Then he exploded in a fit of coughing, as though he'd not been permitted air for some time. When he'd gotten to his feet, he began to hastily undo the lower straps, his lungs whistling loudly in relief. "I do what I can," he said finally, and bowed lightly to both women. A crimson circle appeared on each of his cheeks as the blood pulsed freshly through his body. "As the only surviving historian, it has been my humble duty to make sure the history itself fell into discredit. My fellow historians provided a very accurate depiction of events to come, which truths the monarch sought to hide through my agency. I am not a fraud, Mrs. Brushes, though you should not be troubled for thinking me so. I am an obscurer. My presence here should be enough to convince you that I can see, as it were." "And what have you seen, Mumford?" the monarch said, leaning toward him as though she could take such oracular results into her hands. "I have seen you battle her in the fog of Tamerlane to surprising results," Mumford said. "Don't be so interested in yourself, Mumford. What was the result?" the monarch said, her eyes narrowing. "I cannot be absolutely certain, but I saw you both rising together toward the sky. Whether this constitutes a victory for your majesty, I do not know. Obviously, because you avail yourself of my insights, this was not the only vision I had. I saw you also in Olive, on the edge of the cliff, standing over her body." "Dead," the monarch said hungrily. "To all appearances." "And what did she look like?" "A very old woman." "And how did you know that was her?" "Well," Mumford began, "the little girl laughed, and I imagined, or I concluded, that only you would. As I have told you before, while I am visited by the appearance of forms, I am not given any special information about the specifics. So you may deduce better than I. Would the girl laugh over your body, or you over hers?" The monarch withdrew and began to scan the sky above the foggy forest of Tamerlane. Before rushing off to join her, Mrs. Brushes scrutinized Mumford darkly for a moment to let him know that his vision had only made things more difficult. "What is it?" Mrs. Brushes asked, desperate to return to the monarch's good graces. But it was Mumford who answered, Mumford, who now pointed into the sky. "It is there, Your Majesty," he said, and lowered his eyes while keeping his finger pointing to a heavy cloud floating ominously in the blue sky. "A cloud?" Mrs. Brushes said doubtfully. "Are you sure, Archlesley?" the monarch said. "It is the cloud of stone," he confirmed. "The cloud of stone?" Mrs. Brushes said, and laughed slightly, hoping to force a shared smile to the monarch's lips. "If we begin our battle here, and rise into the sky, and end up in Olive," the monarch began, "we shall have to travel by way of the cloud of stone." The monarch turned to Mumford. "And where is Gittery now?" she asked. Mumford sagged, and then began to tighten the belts around his chest. "If you would permit it, I shall return to the grainy riggings and look." As Mumford gasped his way toward the haystock, the monarch set her eyes, now burning with purpose and delight, on Mrs. Brushes. "When Mumford emerges, you will go exactly where he says and fetch Gittery. But I warn you, do not touch or menace her. Simply bring her to me." Mrs. Brushes nodded, in such a way to express how the crease of her reluctance to following any order from Mumford was clearly folded beneath her higher allegiance to the monarch. "I shall bring the girl here as rapidly as I can," Mrs. Brushes said. "Not here, of course," Mumford wheezed out from the opening of the haystack. "If it has not been made clear to you, Her Majesty will be waiting beneath the cloud of stone." All the year ask for you. You were hanging from a wire. Put your hand into the fire. Lift yourself a little higher. Not a lot of good, a lot can do. Not a lot of good, a lot can do. When you hang from a wire, lift yourself a little. A man arrived at the door, dressed in a dark suit and bearing a yellow page, which he recited as he handed it to her grandfather. At 7:43 on the evening of last night, I regret to inform you, at the hospital of Our Lady of the Keeping, Mrs. Abigail Embers, at the age of 37, did succumb finally. Kittery stood in a blaze of silence behind the door and watched her grandfather received the report of her mother's and his daughter's death with the light clickings of his tongue. When the door shut, the old man folded the sheet into a pocket and then wheeled himself into the hall, perhaps to summon for a servant that Kittery could be called down from her room. But before he could act, Kittery rushed to the door and flung herself outside. She stood, huffing on the porch, her breath uncatchable, and watched the lights of the black car growing smaller in the hills. When the car dropped into the valley, she raced across the cinders and up the slick, cool grass of the highest hill, and felt a measure of relief when she saw the glow of lights return, smaller and dimmer, as though her mother's life could be seen in such a fading away. And when it was gone, she sank down in the mantle of trees above the house, her body damp with the sweat of grief. To cross the cinders of the driveway and bring herself up the porch stairs, to enter the house, to lay down in her bed behind the vine window, would be impossible. Hearing the door slam, her grandfather had followed her out and sat now on the flowing deck. The yellow sheet he'd unfolded from his pocket was like a mean, small fire burning in his hands. Kittery pulled at the grass and rubbed the green cuttings on her legs and then began to bury herself in the leaves and the sticks and whatever she could grab and rip until she was laying beneath a blanket of torn dirt and wildness. Through the sticks, she watched her grandfather struggle to his feet. His silver hair flowed to his shoulders as the blanket dropped to the boards. He once more tightened the yellow page into a small square and slipped it into his pocket. She watched him put his better right leg down first upon each stair and listened to his feet grind the cinders, and then suddenly quiet, he whirred over the softer ground, coming up the hill to meet her. He put a hand on the outstretched tree branch for support. "It was a situation of recurring hemorrhage and infection. I thought I would tell you, so that you might understand. Septicemia is what they call it. Quite curiously, I battled it myself. The liability is in our blood, Kittery, so you may wish to remember the term. I will die from it. Your mother already has. I shouldn't imagine your own death will be much different." He attempted to stoop lower beneath the branch, but his stiff back prevented him. He sighed and glanced around for other supports. "The benefit of age, Kittery, is the benefit of knowing oneself absolutely. Mercilessly, I should say. I am someone roughly worked beyond all manner of care. I have always been this way, but I have not always accepted the chilly feature. Some would call this indifference another liability of our blood, but weakness in one place is strength in another. I ruled this land through a lack of kindness, a lack of heart, and I never missed what I didn't have, and nor should you. Even before you were born, I knew we shared this. There were signs. Your mother was strapped to a bed for the entirety of her pregnancy, and then nearly died when you arrived. Did you know this? Like a bomb you were, exploded inside her. The old man turned his body, a glued mass of bones, and gazed upward at the sky. Then, with a vengeance, because delicacy was no longer possible, he kicked at the sticks that covered her face and pushed her with his foot to force her disclosure. She never did stop bleeding from your arrival, he continued. This is not to hurt you, but just what is. I nearly killed my own mother in the same fashion, and where I suppose I failed, you have succeeded, which itself is a promise of very great and substantial things to come. However difficult that may be for you to fathom at this moment of derangement. But all these recurrences and returns, facts of our blood, Kittery, what happened to me will happen to you. It's obvious and simple, and I say this that you have no delays in your becoming who you are. One day you will wield great power, as I did in my time. One day the word septicemia will come to surround you like a flock of hateful birds. One day you will have nurses pushing you back into your chair, though you are still within the senses of your body to stand. So why do I say all this, you might wonder? In your moment of grief, I find you buried in the moonlight to tell you what you've done. But look here and see yourself, standing over you a century hence. Come free of that dirt and stand before yourself. She remained half covered where she was, beneath the tree, until she could refuse the invitation no more. When she finally stood before him, he placed his cold hands on her head. She lifted her arms as the coldness of his flesh descended, as though to stop the dropping of his skin, the dropping of her own skin. Your father is driving home now and will be here soon. He is quite beside himself with grief and rage. You should prepare for that. He cannot help blaming you for this, and not that he shouldn't. He may protect you from his anger, but you will no doubt sense it. His silence will be all the worse. And he has always been fragile, not a good match for your mother, nor anyone. The sort of man who should have been let loose into the wild, to live alone and disconnected, ever disappearing from view. Such are his responsibilities. Like a bird, his feet never on the ground. Such creatures fare poorly, especially in difficult times. It is a different kind of selfishness that your father suffers from. Where you and I may be perfectly clear and understand why we do what we do, your father is aimless from all proofs. His own actions are obscured by ungovernable and mysterious feelings, which create in him a most constant state of flight. We should be worried about what shall become of him now, with your mother not anchoring him to the earth. We must keep a close watch. Will you come in with me, or will you wait him out? Kittery said nothing, but watched him go back down the hill and mount his chair heavily. He sat for a moment to catch his breath, and then wheeled himself sturdily inside. As to the closing of the front door, she saw a creep of headlights on the distant road. Could it be the man in the dark suit, returning with new information? She imagined a new sheet of paper, white this time, fresh news of her mother's continued life. She stood at the edge of the grass and waited until she heard the familiar twisting tumble of the car engine and knew it was her father. The car roved poorly up the driveway, pulsing and swerving to the mood of its driver. When the car finally stopped, she watched her father climb weakly through the door, as though he was suddenly much too large for it. He stood with wintry eyes until the keys slipped from his fingers. It was the last sound she would ever hear from him, the chilly splash of keys hitting small stones. He neither closed the door nor reached to fetch the keys, but instead stared in a faded way toward the hills, before finally seeing her where she stood. If he came to her now, it would mean everything. But his eyes were glassy with loss. After a moment, he started off toward the sea, his arms buckling strangely at his sides, his legs tricking out uselessly. Kittery watched him from the hill, and then tracked over the green land as he began to pace the beach beyond the shale. She knew that he would not tell her now, that he could not say it without the decoration of anger, and so he would say nothing. Here and there he stopped along the beach and felt his pockets as though everything had gone missing, and then peered in a circumference until he saw her again, the only thing he could see now, high above him on the black rim, staring down. Again their eyes came together in the glassy tendency of before, as though they were seeing the absence of her mother in the shared blindness of their eyes, and again he pulled away, walking fast and crooked along the loose line where the waves came upon the sand. His arms were fluttering at his sides, as though some rope had come to tighten around his chest. She went down the sharp stones, with the rainy fire of tears in her head, broken and fragmentary, and stopped when her feet touched the water. She could call to him. He was not far off now. Even above the ongoing explosion of the waves and the wind, he would hear her. The ocean bit up her legs with cold teeth as she stepped deeper. Her father turned and looked again to the cliff. Not seeing her, he nearly fell to the sand, as though dizzy from not finding her. He spread his legs to prop himself in place against his sickness, and then turned slowly as a clock hand until he saw her in the waves. For a moment he watched her from the shore on shipwrecked legs, but then he stepped himself into the shallow waves. They watched the silver, capsized shadow of sky and ocean, until it was all one long, cold and uncovered form. Kittery didn't hear him slipping through the waves behind her, but when she finally saw him standing beside her in the sea, she thought he'd come to collect her back to the shore, that he would, at any moment, grab her into his arms and slog her through the waves and give her back the gift of himself, and in his embrace she would begin to weep. She would cry because her mother was dead, but the velocity of her sadness, the fuel of it, would be his forgiveness. The moonlight turned the ocean into mercury, and the waves softened in the silver. She watched her father move forward over the mirror, the black shadow of his disruption dragging behind him like a rope she could not grasp. At any moment, she thought, he will turn and face me, and I will walk out to him, and he will lift me into his arms. But he continued deeper, until she wondered if he was trying to cut the silver ocean in half with the blackness of his wake. The oily seam crept together when he disappeared below the water, and she felt herself pulled down too beneath the waves. There was nothing to see but a strand of moonlight lashing through the black depths. But she imagined the silver light extending into the distance. If she followed it, she would find him, arms pulsing in the deep water as he flew away from her and toward her mother. Many years later, as he lay dying, she told her grandfather what she'd seen, how her father had flown off down into the sea to drown, how she'd pulled herself over the sand and up the shale and returned to bed without a word, how she'd left half of herself there, standing in the ocean, staring at the thin light beneath the waves. But the old dying man smiled finally, and for the first time ever in her recollection, when she told him that she was done with all that now, her mother, her father, and the little girl in the sea were all dead now, that he was right. If her coldness was a weakness, she would make a strength of it. She was like him. It was in her blood. I walked down the path through the woods, the falling snow, my neighbor, black as ice, a silver dream, as we go skating down the stream. Available as an e-book for Kindle and other e-book reading devices for 99 cents. Search for Kittery Embers on Amazon.com or visit showandsleeves.com or radioghost.com for more information. The audio chapters will continue to be available for free. Thank you, my friends.